The Claude 3 model family by Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. Haiku is lightning fast and cost effective. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Learn more at anthropic.com/Claude.
I'm Vicki Robin, co-author of Your Money or Your Life. I'm an author, public speaker, social innovator, activist, comedian. Being a saver makes a huge difference in people's lives in a sense of freedom, peace of mind, relaxation. The less debt you have and the more savings you have, especially in these times, a reservoir of savings and not having debt is a liberation of mind and spirit and body.
This is Secrets of Wealthy Women from the Wall Street Journal, helping women empower themselves financially. Now, Veronica Dagger.
Vicki Robin is the best-selling co-author of Your Money or Your Life, a book which many millennials see as inspiration for the financial independence retire early movement. She explains how she lives below her means and what she thinks of the FIRE movement.
Vicki, you were an actress in New York City when you were younger. What did you learn from that experience?
Oh, shaping messages to please an audience. I think that would be true. Yeah, I actually originally wanted to be a theatrical director when I went to Brown University. And I feel like I still am, you know, as an author and public speaker. It's actually a presenting of information in such a way that people are moved, inspired, and their lives are changed.
You had received an inheritance and then decided to move into an intentional community when you were younger. Tell us what happens in an intentional community.
Well, the difference between a community and an intentional community is intentionality, right? So basically, our intention was, number one, to become more aware of ourselves and more honest and real. You know, so that was a spiritual or personal growth intention. And another one was to share resources. That's, you know, usually people who are in an intentional community create a marketplace of services amongst themselves, a sharing economy. It's like an internal sharing economy. So the intentional communities are really part of American history from the Puritans on and the Transcendentalists. And it's happening again, you know, with co-op buildings and people gathering together to add value to their lives.
What inspired you to do that?
I wanted to grow spiritually, and I wanted to, I was very adept and graduated cum laude from Brown University. I was very good at academics and terrible at boiling water, you know, so I just felt like there was another education I needed, and the education was in real life, you know, so basically whether it was learning how to garden or learning how to communicate and learning what my triggers are or, you know, learning about the world, all of that was my education in intentional community.
What do you say the move to the intentional community, was that a rejection of your inheritance of sorts?
No, thank God I had an inheritance, because that small little pile of money I inherited soon, you know, about 6 months before meeting Joe Dominguez, my co-author, who had developed this approach to money for his own early retirement. So he explained to me, I told him what I had and what I was doing with it, which is basically spending it down. And he told me, no, you could invest that. Fortunately, at that time, I was able to buy bonds at 9% interest. Amazing, right? And so that little inheritance became the foundation for me having my sort of real life education, because I was able to live on the interest income from that. As a matter of fact, the very constraints of that income, which was quite low, the very constraints of it were my teachers, you know, because I had grown up in a middle class family on Long Island, and I didn't have access to the basic tools of middle-class life in getting through life, which is paying other people to do everything for you except the small thing that you know how to do. So I learned my way forward.
So your book that you wrote with Joe, it's a 9-step program, and you've said it's not to make people rich, but to figure out how much is enough. How do we know how much is enough?
We know how much is enough by a process of observation of our daily transactions, our financial transactions, but also just, you know, I just observed, you took a sip of water. How much water is enough? Well, your body will tell you. You know, your body tells you, I need water, and then your body tells you, I have enough water, because you're a living being that's paying attention to your health. Same way with your money. You know, it's like we go through life buying things, and some things agree with us more than others. And how do we know they agree with us? Well, one way we know is it making us happy? You know, you could have taken a sip of whiskey, you could have taken a sip of Diet Coke, you could have taken a sip of anything. And then your body tells you, well, this was a really smart choice at this moment. So the same way with our consumer purchases. You know, you have a sense of a need and you go and buy something, and then you can examine, is this making me happy in proportion to what I invested of myself? You know, the time I invested to earn the money to buy this thing. You know, or the time I will invest in the future to earn three times the money if I'm going to buy it with my credit card. You ask yourself, is it worth my time, you know, to have purchased that item? Does it make me happy? Is it in agreement with my values? Is it taking me where I want to go? And in this process of awareness, moment by moment, purchase by purchase, consumption by consumption, eventually people become aware of their enough point, which is the pile of stuff that one needs, whether, you know, stuff could be everything from education to a gym membership to, you know, new shoes. That pile of things that you can purchase that absolutely contributes to your quality of your life and to the direction of your life, but nothing in excess. And that excess, you know, just paying attention so that the excess falls away because it's not worth it to you, overall people will save about 20 to 25% of their expenses.
So in a nutshell, so how do I figure out what a new pair of shoes is really costing me?
Ah, good question. So what we say in Your Money, Your Life is that, you know, besides all the standard definitions of money, money is a store of value. It's a means of exchange. It's, you know, it's a way to prove myself. It's a way we keep score. Besides all of those definitions of money, what we say is money is something we trade the hours of our lives for. So what is that exchange? And what we've discovered is once people calculate their nominal hourly wage and then they realize, oh, on top of that, you know, I have, on top of my 8-hour workday, every hour I work, I spend an extra X number of hours, you know, commuting and getting educated and all the things I do, all the way I spend my time associated with that 1 hour of earning money. I have to calculate that in. And then all the things that I have to purchase, whether it's, you know, from the, you know, the train ticket to, you know, the suit of clothes, all the things I have to purchase in order to bring myself fully to the workplace. And when people do that calculation, they realize that their real hourly wage is probably about a third or a quarter of their nominal hourly wage. And so then you have a figure that you can use to examine whether some purchase is worth it. Is it worth an hour of my life?
What do you say to people say that, you know, that just sounds like it takes so much time and effort?
You know, all change takes time in the transition. You just basically, you establish systems and new habits. Once you've done that transition, it's easy. It's just a new way of doing things. And anybody who's changed their diet or their exercise or, you know, how they use their time, any change process is really a question of developing new habits. So, I mean, there are people who've gotten onto this that take a weekend. A lot of times they'll take it the weekend with their partner and they go through the book and they do the, you know, some of the exercises and they talk about what they want to do about it and they set up systems. You know, that you can set up online accounting systems. I pay for everything with debit card, not a credit, a debit card, so that my bank has a complete record of all my expenses, and that allows me to do this contemplation of what expenses really were worth it to me. So that's not a hard thing to do, just establish that habit or establish the habit of collecting receipts for the things that you purchase. And so then, you know, and there are free programs that you, even my bank now is linked to an accounting program that will help you do a tracking process. There are free programs that allow you to project your expenses over time. And if you need to, you know, if you need to hire, you know, take a class or hire a coach or go to a, you know, support group, if you need to do something so that you can be with other people and they can tell you how they did it and they can walk you through it, great, do it that way. I mean, It's the old way. If there's a will, there's a way. And I don't mean to be, you know, I don't mean to diminish how hard it is to change our habits. But once you want something more than you want stuff, once you want something more than you want your suffering, then change. It's easier to change yourself. If you don't have a big motivation for change, then it does feel like your second grade teacher with a ruler is trying to make you do something.
Well, what benefits would I get from, it sounds like, essentially living lower than my means, you know, spending less than I earn, saving more, maybe depriving myself? I mean, what do you say to people who think this sounds not like a good time?
Yeah, well, I say that I buy my freedom with my frugality every day. I don't deprive myself, but when I'm like an Olympian, you know, enough person, yeah, because I really know myself and I really know which things work and which things don't. And I'm constantly titrating on a daily basis, you know, like here I am in New York City. Do I walk? Do I take the subway? Do I take a cab? You know, you're always doing this titration about like, what does my body want? How do I feel? So what I say is nobody wants to do obsessive accounting except for like obsessive accounters, you know, but we want something. And so I want dominion. I want sovereignty over my time. And that desire, I know that I have that linked up, that, you know, if I go unconscious about money, I almost think at this point in my life, it would be very hard for me to do that. But to go unconscious about my finances is to lengthen my period of time that I have to work for other people doing things I don't exactly want to do. So I think, you know, the basic thing, we have forgotten to be a nation of savers, and credit cards has certainly aided and abetted that. I think being a saver makes a huge difference in people's lives in a sense of freedom, peace of mind, relaxation. The less debt you have and the more savings you have, especially in these times, a reservoir of savings and not having debt is a liberation of mind and spirit and body.
Do you think it's really practical, though, for people who have children or student loans, for example?
Of course it is. I mean, how could saving money not be practical? You know, I mean, just even the old, I think it was, who was it who said, the difference between a rich man and a poor man is a pence. You know, if you have a penny more than your expenses, you're rich. If you have a penny less, you're poor. This, I'm not talking about monumental quantities of money. I'm talking about becoming fit. Financially fit. And if you have children, of course you want to do that. One of the things you want to do is you want to figure out all the programs that there are, you know, the tax programs and the social service programs, everything that's there to support you as a parent so that parenting doesn't have to cost an arm and a leg in your entire future and your child's future. And when you want that, you will get enterprising. And, you know, it's just one weekend of reading the blogs and you'll find those bloggers who figured out exactly what you need to know. There's an amazing generosity I find in this FIRE community, Financial Independence Retire Early. There's 1,700 personal finance bloggers. Of course, it's, you know, monetizing their blogs, but a lot of it is just pure generosity. They do the research for you. Anything you want to find out, you can do. And so it's really, it's basic prudence. It's stunning that we don't teach this. It's stunning that we have educated a population to think that I have to be unconscious because I have children.
Key part of the FIRE movement, which you just mentioned, is this whole idea of retiring early, potentially. Sometimes that can mean just not having a W-2 type situation at work. But what do you say to people who feel they need to work in order to find meaning?
I say everybody has to work in order to find meaning. You know, we have aggregated like four things that are not all the same: job, income, work, and identity. And everybody has a basic work. Your first basic work is to be a loving human being. Second basic work is civics, is to be engaged in the world around you in a way that's positive. Whatever you think positive is, I mean, you may disagree with my politics, but I would respect you if you are engaged in carefully thinking about what your values are and what kind of world you want to bring into being. I can have a conversation forever with you about that. So we all have a basic work of being a human being and a basic work of being a human being in families and society. That is, you know, we have a work that comes out of some mysterious combination of our talents, our histories, what we love to do, our biology, what our bodies are good at, and exercising our best qualities is the pure joy in life. Some people get to do that and get paid for it, but most of us don't. So there's a thing called a job, and sometimes we try to approximate job and work, trying to put those two things together. But if you think your job is your work and then you retire, you're in a big identity crisis. You know, so because you've lost your identity, you've lost your community, you've lost time structuring. So my thing is that, yeah, we're all going to work from the day we're born to the day we die. Getting an education is work. Learning to walk is work. You know, children work a lot harder than adults. But sometimes for a period of time, we're going to invest some of our time in making money. And if you save money and invest, and you can have income that you usually turn to a job for through your investments. But you continue to work no matter what. And that's what you said. You know, maybe you stop your W-2, but you're a consultant, or you're writing your novel, or you get in the sailboat and sail around the world.
This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Plus, save time by completing security questionnaires with Vanta AI. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ. That's VANTA.com/WSJ.
You're listening to Secrets of Wealthy Women from the Wall Street Journal.
You say many people act out of a victim mentality when it comes to the size of their earnings. What do you mean by that?
A lot of us, if we're not taking responsibility for the fact that no matter who's signing our paycheck, we are always an entrepreneur. You know, we are always responsible for our own work lives. The world I was born into, you know, you would have one job. You get a job and you would have that job and you would retire from that job and then you would do your retirement years. And so you could go unconscious about, you know, slotting yourself in someplace and just assuming that everybody around you is going to organize the work product and, you know, organize life for you. You just have to show up and do your little piece. I don't think that's true anymore. I don't think it's true or safe for anybody to just sort of like plop down in a job that's been given to them and grouse about it. But not take responsibility for seeing where else they can go in their own company or what else they might be able to do, or is there a side gig, or, you know, it's like we're in a process of continual self-development, not out of desperation, but because that's the most fun thing to do.
What advice do you have for women facing a pay gap?
I think we just need to work inwardly on our own deservingness. Now we're stepping outside of your money, your life, and we're stepping into like Vicky. and as a woman, I understand. I understand that whatever it is that, you know, a man thinks he needs to know 51% of a field in order to demand a high pay, and a woman thinks that if I don't understand at least 97% of it, I can't do that. You know, it's like there's a permission thing that goes on. And so I think a lot of the battle is internal, of just being able to understand that we have inherited an attitude toward ourselves that is reflected in the marketplace. And so part of our work is to work on all the pieces of the undeservingness and show up with our own number that we think we deserve.
Can you give us some practical advice on how we can save more money coming from somebody who lives frugally?
There's the sort of nickel and diming yourself to death. I live on an island in the Pacific Northwest. My town has two main streets, each a block long. So, you know, I have adapted to rural living. And I notice walking around New York that you have to be very conscious or you're going to spend a lot of money. Just, you know, it's expensive to walk around New York. So I was already thinking as I was coming over here, you know, okay, so if I lived here, I would figure out a system where I would have a cold pack, you know, with a series of things in it that I would bring from home. It would take me 2 minutes to put it in my backpack, and, you know, and I would have my snacks during the day, and I would have my water with me, and I would, you know, so I would figure it out. I mean, guaranteed I would figure this thing out. So that's the nickel and diming yourself to death. And then there is also this sort of the big ticket things by not questioning assumptions. Like I've bought story that's in the book of a woman who was about to sign on the dotted line about buying a new car, and she had a realization because she just read Your Money, Your Life. She said, I actually have a car. She hadn't noticed that she had a car. She just presumed that somebody in her profession at her level would have a new car in this at this point that would be a marker of her success. And she didn't buy the car because she had a car. I mean, that's a major insight. Or the insight of, the rent to own, you know, renting or owning your house, you know, how many square feet is enough, a house for you? What's the purpose of the extra rooms? Where else could I hold my meetings and meet my friends? And, you know, you start to think, you know, what do you use from house? Like, you know, about the people who die and there's, you know, there's stacks of newspapers in the living room, and then there's just this the little path from the chair to the kitchen to the bathroom to the bed, and then there's like a 2,000 square foot house that's not being used. So you really just need to think strategically about what do you actually need, and what of the things that you have are you actually using? And if you're not using, if you're paying for things that you're not using, benefits that don't mean anything to you, then you let those things go. Those are big ticket items. Every car I've bought, I've identified the car I want, and then I call around to all the dealerships within 100 miles, and I tell them exactly what I want and what's their best price. I've always gotten a car for 30% less.
Some people will hear this and say, yeah, it sounds great. However, I want to show or portray a certain lifestyle because it shows to my neighbors and my friends that I have achieved success. And if I don't have those things that show that I have achieved success, how are they going to know?
Well, you know, I just say read The Millionaire Next Door. You know, a lot of people who are millionaires have very modest lifestyles. So trying to convey a greater worth, I mean, I'm not dissing it. If that's what you want to spend your life energy on, money is life energy. You've worked hard and you can spend your money on anything you want. And if having a car or a house or, you know, landscaping, if what ever you want that is going to really bring you joy and really take you where you want to go, if that's it for you, more power to you. I mean, I know plenty of people I love, who invest themselves in certain markers of success, and they love having it. They don't want to change it. They don't want to hear from me about it, and I don't have any judgment. All I want is for you to be able to look me in the eye and say, I'm choosing this, and I'm having a ball choosing it. I love my portico on my house and the circular drive.
What do you think of the whole FIRE movement, which you're sort of an icon for?
Yeah, right. I had no idea it existed. When I took on the update of Your Money, Your Life about a year ago, I had no idea there was such a thing. FIRE is financial independence, retire early. And so I've been sort of like a sociologist as well as, you know, a granny. You know, people look at me like one person said, you're like the Eve of Adam and Eve. You know, Your Money, Your Life is one of the core texts. I'm fascinated with how strong the movement is. And I think in part it's because there's these opportunities. I mean, a lot of tech people, there's a lot of left brain people, and there's a lot of opportunity in this economy for some people to make a lot of money. And so they see that they can see this possibility, especially people in tech and engineering, etc., or any profession where there's this, like, or people who figure out online businesses, you know, or entrepreneurs. You know, there's people who see that this opportunity and realize that it can work for them. They run the numbers. And so I think it indicates that this economy is providing opportunities for people who are very ambitious to save a lot of money. I think the online universe makes it, you know, some people can make a lot of money in that universe. It's sort of like a new highway system, and, you know, you can truck all sorts of stuff along that highway system. And I also think there's a sense of insecurity for everybody in this economy. Nobody knows how long their job is going to last, you know, whether it's AI and robotics, whether it's outsourcing, whatever it is, you know, industries are winking in and out of being. Things that didn't exist 5 years ago exist now and may not exist in the future. So that level of insecurity, I think, has a lot of people saying, I want to shore up my own ship. I can't be dependent on this leaky tanker that's called the economy. So I'm very interested that it's flourishing now, and I see a lot of flavors in it too. I mean, the sort of center point seems to be more libertarian, but there are socialist people in the fire movement. There's spiritual people in the fire movement. There's, you know, environmentalists in the fire movement. It is a big bucket of values, and all of them people realizing that if I wake up about money, somehow or another, the things that I care about most, I can land sooner and have more of. So I'm fascinated with it, and I'm heartened by it, and I'm also disturbed by it, because it's also the idea of financial independence. It's great, but if you don't use your freedom in service to something higher than just yourself, then what are we doing other than taking a lot of smart people out of, you know, the common project called, you know, our society? I hope that people who pull the trigger, they say in the fire movement, you know, who graduate from the W-2, I hope these people turn their attention, their incredible intellectual power, the commitment that got them FI, I would love to see that commitment to solving the problems of our world. And to me, that would be the most exciting outcome.
Time now for your secrets.
I'm Vicki Robin. I'm author of Your Money, Your Life, writer, public speaker, and my money secret is never buy anything new, except for underwear.
For more of Vicki's story and the FIRE movement, head to WSJ.com and check out Ann Turgeson and My Story. This episode was produced by Tanya Bustos. John Wardock is the executive producer of WSJ Podcasts. I'm Veronica Dagger. Thanks for listening.
What's your secret? Let us know. Write podcasts@dowjones.com or on Twitter, use #SecretsOfWealthyWomen.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.